Is the way we experience love in this modern age broken? And how do you live a fulfilling and happy relationship? And how do you deal with divorce? How do you find fulfillment in your work and in your life? And how do you build resilience to stay consistent through the adversities, the ebbs and flows and challenges of life? So in this podcast, I talk with Jane and we unpack all those things. So if you want to go on a journey, an honest and upfront experience of what it's like to do the fundamentals of what it means to be a human, then have a listen. Where were you born? Do your parents love you?
I was born in North Devon, so southwest of England. My parents did love me. Yeah. And, you know, I think my dad still does. I talk to him every Friday. He's still going strong at 93.
Wow.
So, living independently. So, you know, I've got a lot to live up to. And so he's always been a good dad. Yeah, I had a very, very lovely childhood growing up in sort of rural southwest England, near to beaches, surrounded by fields, village life. Everyone in the village knew each other, very social. Small primary school, great. Loved it.
What do you think is the cost of that rural life? Like, because it seems to make more sense, humans are in communities, we're connecting, we're having fun, you're more connected to nature, you're probably eating better because you might be growing your own stuff.
Yeah. I mean, my dad sort of had a huge veggie garden. He would feed half the village, at certain points. I think that whole sort of sense of community is... It's sad that we're losing it and that we have lost it a lot. The whole sense of security, of sharing, of safety, knowing everyone that was around you, kids growing up together, long-term friendships, the era that we're in now is very, very different to that. When I look at sort of my kids, grandkids, their communication, the ways that they keep in touch with their friends, etc. And obviously it's things like Facebook and social technology are beneficial for people like me that have left, all your friends and family overseas. And it is a great means of keeping in touch, but it doesn't replace obviously the picking up the phone, the conversations, meeting people for a beer. I find it sort of quite sad. I really look back on that sort of village life and, as a real privilege to having grown up in that sort of period, as it were.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It's like, so people call me a failure because I live with six people and it's by choice. And it's like...
Yeah.
Because it's a massive house and the way I see it. So I just rent, head tenant, and then I go... I do like a massive amount of viewings to find people that I really like and value and feel like we could learn from each other. And then we sit down and eat, we talk, we have fun. And I just feel like most people swiping through their phones, living a meaningless existence at a job they hate, this doesn't really make sense to me. I don't really.
No, I mean, what is there in life if it's not sort of connections with people,
Has there been something as you've gotten older that you used to think was important, but it's actually not?
I think, a lot of the status symbols, because when it all drills down to it, the things that bring me joy in my life are, hanging out with my family. And that doesn't have to be expensive, doesn't have to be flash. It's just sitting on the deck, with some cheese and crackers with friends, family, and having a good conversation. I'm a real proactive person when it comes to keeping in contact with people, making things happen, keeping the family together, making sure I've kept in touch with, wider family members. I try and go out of my way to do that because I think family and friends are, all you've got really at the end of the day.
That's the most important thing. It's bizarre. This, for me, like I'm real anal about agreements. Like if I make a meeting, I stick to it and I turn up at the time. But
yeah,
the exception is, you know, if there's someone important in my life that's in need, that who cares about whatever thing I need to do with work? You know what I mean? Like, it's what's more important than the people you love?
Things exactly.
Seem to be backwards.
Yeah. And, you know, I've always been fortunate to kind of work in roles and positions where, you know, family has always come first, sort of thing, you know. And we bring that into our business. You know, we always sort of say, you know, family comes first. If you've got an issue or something you need to attend to, then, you know, all good, we'll cover, you know, we'll make it work.
You think about replicating that type of community in the workplace, because they say if you want to live a fulfilling life, the most effective way to change the things holding you back is to change your environment, or it's your upbringing, which you can't do much about. But most of your life is at work, and if you're not happy and you're not connected at work, it's pretty tough. So do you think about how to maintain that connection in the workplace, or rituals you go through, or?
Well, we try, sort of thing. I mean, we're fortunate in that we're a small office. You know, there's four of us in there. And, you know, we very much cover each other's workload if something comes up. I mean, both Charlene and I are English. And so we've had, you know, aging overseas parents, and we've both had to take, or suddenly be overseas for extended periods because, you know, we needed to be there for family. And so, you know, 3 months out of the office at a drop of a hat, you know, we've covered, we've made it work. And with the other employees, you know, we kind of say, you know, if you need to go because your kids, you know, need you or something else, then yeah, just go, you know, we'll make it work, we'll cover. And it's all about sort of, we know each other really well within the office, as you'd expect at that sort of size. We work closely together, but we know what's going on in each other's lives. We watch out for each other. We try and make it a family, family friendly environment. But we know each other pretty well as well. So,
yeah, I never really got this, you know, conscriptive work thing. You got to be here at 9, finish at 5. Nah. You got to work this amount of thing. You got to beg me to let you go have holiday leaves, and you're only allowed this much. Where do you think that comes from, or why do you? Because I mean, I know people are complacent, and I know people, you know, need certain boundaries in order to succeed in life. But I don't know; it doesn't seem to make sense to me.
It doesn't seem to make sense, and you know, I look at, you know, my children, sort of thing, and you have a huge diversity in terms of, I mean, they're all very disciplined when it comes to work. They're all very committed, but they're very different in terms of, you know, some will just prioritize work over a lot of other things. Others, you know, will do the family thing first. And you kind of think there's some kind of mindset, you know, whether it's innate, you know, that just kind of says, you know, I need to focus on work. I'm there for 9 to 5. I can't take more than, you know, if I go 5 minutes over my lunch break, I'm going to be hammered for it. And I don't even think that even comes from the top. It's a mindset that's been drilled in to them from something or somewhere. That, you know, to keep your job, you have to play by the rules, kind of thing, 100%. And actually, you know, and I kind of say to them, well, you know, you need to push the boundaries. You know, if you're a good employee, then most employers will, you know, be happy to bring in the flexibility, you know?
Yeah, it's wild.
But they're too scared often to push the boundary and to upset the apple cart because they feel that the job security is, you know, with the mortgage and everything else is what is, you know, the more important side of it.
Do you find it easy to have those challenging conversations, or if not, what's helped you to communicate that, where you're like, you're going to have to talk to someone and tell them, hey, you know, I'm not going to do what you want?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been happy to negotiate, you know. So, you know, when I was an employee, you know, I had three sets of maternity leave. Life got more and more busy for me from a family perspective. And then so every time it would be a case of actually, I need to renegotiate my contract, you know, or my working hours or my flexibility, my ability to work from home, whatever it might be. You know, and this is what I want kind of thing. And, you know, I would always say that I was a committed worker. I would get the job done. And my employers always saw that sort of thing. And so it was then a case of, okay, you know, you do you, you know, get the job done, you know, in whatever way suits you best. And you end up with a much more rounded, happier employee, you know?
Makes sense. What is your take on this new generational viewpoint that, you know, career first, motherhood second, you know, and being extreme independence and the inability to, you know, be vulnerable and connect and have a partnership, you know, wanting to be this independent, career driven, take over the world sort of vibe at the expense of potential family in your 40s? What's your take on that for young women?
I mean, I think you probably need all of, you know, all types of those people. You need the driven people. You need, you know, some people out the front doing the leadership. For the majority, I'd say, you know, it's sad for the families. You know, you look at the kids coming through, you know, we'll never really know the kind of the damage or the benefit of that sort of thing, of that kind of approach to whether it's family life, parenting and everything else. You know, maybe I'm just old school traditional, you know. You know, I look at my childhood where my mum was a stay-at-home mum. And so, you know, we had that benefit. I wasn't a stay-at-home mum, but I was always there after school sort of thing. So, you know, I did the part-time 9 till 3 kind of thing so that I could work around school hours. I feel that I had the best of all worlds, you know, and I love that. I know other people that sort of have had to put the career first, if that's how you want to put it, because to keep a roof over the head, some meals on the table, it's just reality. So, you know, there is no right and wrong. Sometimes circumstances dictate it, and, you know, that's not what people ideally would want. But, you know, you just have to make the best of your own situation. You know, with anything you do, you know, in our world of financial planning, there's never, you know, two situations that are different, that are the same. Everything's different. So whether it's circumstances, your own drive, motivation, you know, you can't just kind of have a blanket approach and say that that's right or that's wrong. It's what works for you.
Do you find like consistencies around trends of with financial planning? So we would often ask people what's important about money and why, and it was like security, choice, and freedom was often how it sort of formulated. But do you sort of either have a process to unpack to find what the true desire they want from the working with you, or, and if so, do you see trends and consistencies of what people want?
I think those things are still very much, you know, the initial words that come out. You know, it's all about security, peace of mind, you know, knowing that they can retire at a certain age, etc. You know, we try and do a lot of uncovering, because a lot of that's in the future, you know, and you don't know that you've been financially secure until you get to the end, you know. Yeah. So you know, so how can you sort of, it's all about uncovering the steps to get there and then finding out, you know, well, you know, what are the things that you're going to look back on life and say, you know, damn it, I really wish that I'd done that. Or, you know, my career's gone completely the wrong way to what I wanted. You know, is it really feasible for me to actually do, you know, what I want to do? You know, or, you know, travel's obviously a big thing, and bucket list type expenses, etc. But it's sort of saying, you have these big words in terms of security, retirement, peace of mind, but really, you know, what does that actually mean? And we do try and have sort of some in-depth conversations and drill down through some, you know, software that we're using that we're just sort of trialing, but just sort of saying, you know, so how do these things, the things that you want to do, the activities, the experience you want to have, how do they align with any other values that you're talked about in terms of family? You know, there's a huge pressure on families these days to feel that they're going to have to help their children at some point as well, you know, into properties or whatever it might be. And, you know, and trying to get that balance right and kind of say, well, actually, you know, do you help your kids or do you make sure that your own financial security is there in place first? Because if your financial security falls over, you know, you're going to be living with the kids. Is that an ideal situation? Well, no.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I want to see financial planners going, is more the life coaching route, because it's a commodity. Like, I mean, finance, I reckon maybe this is a simplification, but I think if you really wanted to, in 2 weeks, you could probably learn enough to achieve financial freedom. You know, you understand wills, enduring powers of attorney, the right cover. You understand managed funds. You can recognize when a fund manager is not good, and then you just leave it the fuck alone for, you know, 10 years or whatever. Like, it's not like the hard part is, hey, my money's gone down by 30%. I'm not going to freak out. I'm just going to sit here and watch it go up again.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all about sort of behavior, isn't it? And kind of saying, you know, don't stress about that side of it. You know, you focus on, you know, what you're doing, which is putting the money aside or paying down the debt or doing whatever, and just have faith in the actual plan, of the financial plan, to do its thing. But it's all about the soft decisions that come along the way. It's all about the fear, you know, just sort of, you know, what happens when the markets, like you say, shit themselves, you know, not stressing, not panicking, not making major swings in choices, you know, and just sort of saying, you know, this is life, you know, just carry on. You know?
How do you mentally prepare people for that? Because I would almost try and scare people away from being a client. I'll be like, hey, this is what's going to happen. How are you going to react? We can't predict the future, but usually it can go down for 3 to 4 years, potentially at this rate. And over 7 to 10 years goes up. How will you deal with that? How do you deal with that?
It is really hard. And, you know, you try and sort of put numbers around it. And, you know, you sort of say to people, you know, what, you know, if your portfolio goes backwards 20%, you know, how are you going to feel about that? And, oh, yeah, you know, I'll be fine. And then you kind of put it into numbers and say, well, you know, that's 100 grand. You know, so if your portfolio is, you know, you come and see me and it's dropped by 100,000, you know, you invest, you know, 500,000 and you come and see me and it's worth 400,000, how are you going to feel? Oh, yeah, you know, oh, I'll be fine, I'll deal with that kind of thing. And you kind of think, really? you know, you get to the first quarterly. So we see people sort of the first 3 months after they've invested and make sure that they're happy with their online access, you know, they're, you know, understand the reporting and what they're seeing on the screen and everything. And it's really good if it's gone backwards in that first 3 months, because then the conversation is a lot realer. They're looking at these figures and they're seeing that actually, oh, it hasn't been a positive return. How am I feeling now? You know, because my money that I physically put into this investment is less than it was. You know, has my heart rate gone up? You know, am I feeling stressed? You know, and you can have much better relatable conversations about what loss is like. You know, and it's all very well to see it on paper and see a chart that goes up and down, but until you're actually, you know, physically seeing it, you know, it doesn't, you don't know what you're going to feel like, sort of thing. So it's great to then have those conversations, say, great, you know, this is what it feels like. You have to get used to that, because that's going to happen, you know, on a regular basis. But you just have to trust, you know, the long term, we're going to have the upward trends kind of thing.
Interesting.
I always like it when my first quarterly report is a negative one.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it's similar when we're training salespeople. The person that made the sale quickest and had a run were the ones that left. And the ones that didn't do as well at the start, but then worked it out, are the ones that stayed.
Yep.
And it was the emotional fortitude they developed and the reward. They did it with rats as well, actually. So they put this rat, it's pretty horrific, but they put them in a bucket and they would put them in there and then just let them go. They couldn't get out and then they'll slowly start to drown and then they'll pick them out. But the ones that they picked out swam something like twice as long because they had hope.
Okay.
So they saw as possible that they'll get out if they just kept going. And I wonder how many people in life are like that as well. It's like if they only knew that the pot of gold was that, you know, 10 shovels deep and they stopped at 9.
And they stopped at 9. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, you know, and you've got plenty of real life stories that you can sort of tell people of, you know, markets going backwards. I mean, I started in financial services in 89. So, you know, in the UK, we then had the big sort of tech wreck situation. And, you know, we had plenty going on. And there's been plenty of negative stories. And when you've kind of been through them, you know, it makes life easier to share the realities and share the actual, the scary stories of, you know, how bad it can be. But then, you know, you just have to stick to the plan and just be resilient, you know.
Just on the resilience, right, has there been points of your life where you've required it and you'd had to lean into that?
Personally?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I've made big changes in my life, I guess, and I've had, and at the time, they felt sort of like they were, you know, major sort of issues, decisions. But then, you know, same with anything. You look back in 5 years' time and think, well, was that really such a big deal? You know, it's life's moved on. You know, things have changed. I got through that period. You know, I might have other issues and trials at the moment, but, and yes, they might be less in comparison, but actually they've made me stronger. They've made me at whatever position I'm in now because of that trial that I went through. You know, I'm very much I guess I would consider myself definitely a glass half full type of person. I think more about the, you know, regretting things I didn't do rather than things I've done, you know, so you kind of move on. I mean, I had the opportunity here to move to, so I'm married to a Kiwi sort of thing. You know, he was living here at the time. We hadn't seen each other for sort of 4 years. And he kind of said, oh, you know, why don't you come over here and give it a go kind of thing. And I was pretty happy in my life in the UK, you know, good job, village life, 3 kids, all going well, no reason to leave. You know, and it was kind of, well, if I don't do this, I'll always have the what if, you know. So I kind of thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. You know, I'll go. If I don't like it, I can come back. But it, for me, it had to be a lock, stock and barrel. So it had to be sell the house. You know, I had to come committed and make the decision. I couldn't be half-hearted and kind of keep a house back there so that if it didn't work, I could go back, you know.
Mm.
That I had to make it sort of hard. So to have the, you know, full commitment by making sure that, you know, for this period, I was going to give it my all. If it didn't work out, obviously, you know, nothing's finite, really.
Yeah, decisions, then. I think that's the, I guess, the part that's lacking in love these days for young people is commitment. It's almost as though it's like anxiety-inducing. People think, you know, I've got all this choice on Tinder or Bumble, I'm swiping away, you know, and choice is the actual, the true choices, reward.
Yeah.
But it's really not. Like they did a study with paintings where they had two groups. One was given a painting they keep forever, One was giving a painting that they can change in 6 months. And you'd think the one that has an option to change would choose the best one and the happiest, but they're not. It's the ones that had no other choice. So what is your perception of modern love and how we can, I guess, are we better or are we worse? Or how do we find this person to fly halfway around the world for?
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, I find it obviously hard to relate to sort of how you look at someone's picture on a screen and think, oh, yeah, you know, that's a bit of me, you know. You know, I mean, obviously, yes, I look at someone on the TV and I watched Naked Attraction last night and I looked at all of them and thought, oh, God, I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do that, you know.
It's an interesting show, that one, of all the comparisons. Yeah, go by feet. Exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So I think it's what we were saying at the beginning. It's all about the connection, isn't it, sort of thing, and whether that's community connection, love connection. And I think it's getting harder and harder to find that. And because we don't have the community hubs where you sort of, you know, meet up with your mates and there's a mutual kind of thing, or there's a central pub or whatever, you know, village pub like we used to have, sort of thing. But, you know, there's a lot of people that have found their true loves through, you know, your Tinders, your Bumbles and everything else. But whether it's a harder route because there's no kind of initial mutual. I mean, who is really honest when they're putting up their profiles?
No, especially with the pictures. Gosh, you end up on some dates and you're like, you're a different human being.
Yeah, well, exactly, kind of thing. And even what you say, I mean, yes, I enjoy, you know, but I enjoy hiking, kind of thing. Well, yeah, maybe once every 4 years, you know, I have done a hike, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, actually, very true.
I'm a Saturday morning lie-in with a paper and a crumpet, you know. So.
Well, I watched this TED talk. It was quite interesting. It was like, it was talking about hormones and dating, which is I never thought of it in that way. It was it started from a conversation from her grandma, and her grandmother said to her, "You know what's wrong with your generation? You just get into bed too quickly." And then she's like, "I wonder if I could prove this scientifically." So she did it with some type of animal. It's kind of like a rat, but not a rat. It's something, because humans, it's quite tricky to do it. Yeah. And they found that oxytocin's produced, and that's a good indication of pairing. So when you're feeling good, oxytocin's made. And if you're producing testosterone and this other chemical, it's quite hard to produce oxytocin. It like blocks the receptors. So what happens with women is when they go home with a guy and they have a great experience, they start producing pairing chemicals like oxytocin. Whereas the guy, he actually produces testosterone, which blocks his oxytocin. So he's less likely to pair. What makes him pair is the moment of commitment. So it's actually getting to know the girl, committing, and then going home together. Whereas what we're doing is going home together and then avoiding the commitment. And then what do you think there's a problem with the way we were doing things now? Or what's your thoughts on, are we getting into bed too soon, like the grandma said?
I would never judge anyone. I couldn't judge anyone for getting into bed too soon. That would be very hypocritical. But I mean, I find it hard. I mean, you got a partner, or how do you meet your last?
I'm a recovering whore, if you're wondering. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm trying to get to know people now. I'm a changed man. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Probably shouldn't use that W word,
isn't it? Because if you're jumping into bed with people, or that is the connection kind of thing, it's you know, if you want a relationship that's long term, you know, and you know, marriage, kids, the whole package, then you know, you have to go beyond that sort of initial side of things, and just kind of, it's all, to me, it's all about the social the other connections, the conversations, the love, not just the physical. And I guess because I haven't done that side of it in terms of dating apps and things, you know, you get the impression that it is just all sort of about the physical attributes, you know, initially kind of thing. So, but, you know, each to their own.
It's a transaction.
Yeah.
It says you lose a piece of your soul, honestly. I swear, like, it's like the Horcrux in Harry Potter. Like, every time you have a meaningless connection, you lose a piece of yourself.
Piece
but anyways,
of
we should move on. Yeah. This is probably inappropriate. But what on the long-term marriage, like, what's been useful or rituals that you find is quite helpful, whether it's like having a date night once a month or talking about the family so you're on a cohesive unit, or do you find things have been helpful to maintain the bond over long periods of time?
Most of it's all about making sure you spend time with each other and quality time. You know, when you've got young kids, etc., that becomes hard. But yes, there's always, and even if it's just when the kids are in bed, you actually take time to maybe not have the TV on, or to take longer over dinner, you know, and just have the conversations, not to make life all a rush, you know, and to just, it doesn't have to be an actual date night going out and the romance side of it, but it's all about making sure that you do connect with the person, you know, properly on a regular basis, because we can get so wrapped up in being busy and doing our own thing and, you know, rushing in, shoveling down your dinner. One of you might watch TV, one of you might have some work to catch up on, all that kind of thing. And then actually you find you haven't really had a proper conversation about anything meaningful for a long while. You know, so you start going off in different tangents. It's not hard to keep a relationship alive. But it is just making the effort.
How do you know in the moments when, let's say, you're faced adversity and you're disconnected in your relationship, how do you determine whether, hey, this is something I'm fighting for, or hey, this is something I should leave? Like, how do you know to, like, put in that effort? Because it's scary. Because that's all us. I think a lot of young people, especially me, I'm like, oh, run from commitment. Oh, it's too hard. Oh, latest. Like, that's not a good approach. So,
I've never been scared of commitment, but then, you know, I was divorced from my first, I've been through divorce kind of thing. So I've had a relationship that didn't work long term. You know, we had 12 or 13 years. But then you know, when you got to the stage where, for whatever reason, you know, there was no future. Definitely kind of not feeling that you need to, you've got to believe in your own self-worth, you know, so it's not staying in a relationship because of the kids or because I can't afford to leave it or all those types of reasons. It's about, you know, trying to get the network around you that's supporting enough to say, actually, you know, you can do this, we've got your back, you know, get out while you can kind of thing, you know, move on. There's a whole life ahead of you. What is the point of being miserable or even 50% miserable? You know, life's too short, you know.
How do you know if it's worth fighting for or not? Or you don't? Or you just deep down, you know, just making up bullshit excuses?
I think deep down, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because if you're questioning whether it's worth fighting for,
there's your answer.
There's your answer. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Has there been something that's been quite helpful in healing and still being able to connect with others since then?
I guess when, you know, back in at that particular stage of my life, when I was, it's all about forgiving and, if that's what you need to do. But also just remembering that, you know, for me, I've always been very much, I guess I'm a peacemaker in terms of I don't need to have unnecessary conflict in my life. It's a negative sort of energy. If I don't need to, if I have to have a connection with the person, you know, through kids or whatever else, then I'm not going to make that a negative environment, you know, because I've got the rest of my life ahead of me. You know, I will always kind of go out my way to, you know, keep the relationships civil, keep them, you know, easily comfortable so that there's no stress or strains and things like that for the people around us, friends. And I wouldn't ever expect friends to make a choice, you know, between me and a partner that split up or something like that, or I never did. You know, we could rumble along in the same circles, and you know, because again, you know, for me, I'm a glass half full. Life's too short. You're there, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing. We can move on parallel, but completely separate, and it not be an issue for me, sort of thing. You know, and that's that whole thing of, I guess, particularly when you're living in a small village community type thing, you know, you can't afford to divide a village kind of thing. So
yeah,
you have to rumble along.
You think you talked about something important there. It's forgiveness. I think that's the most powerful thing I've ever learned, is just because all blame is saying, hey, I give this person power over me. You know, it's like, yeah, hey, I'm going to think about them when they're not here. I'm going to be upset about it when they're not here. And forgiveness. Yeah. What has helped you not be jaded and to forgive?
I think it is very much that, you know, you've got to put life in perspective. You know, I'm a small, you know, we're all grains of sand on this earth. You know, we're all trying to do, you know, I try and do things that are consciously good, I suppose. You know, I'm not a, I try and be positive for people around me. I try and be encouraging, supportive and everything else. And really, you've got to look at, you know, who's the person that actually gets the negative from being either unforgiving or resentful or all the rest of it. It would be me. You know, it's my life that's actually the one that's going to be downhill, depressing, stressful. You know, a relationship, you know, a relationship breakdown, yes, it has a huge impact, but it's a part of your life. It makes you into what, you know, it makes you stronger, makes you perhaps more decisive on what you don't want in a person going forward, you know, all those types of things. But you just have to look at it as something that's going to make you bigger and better going forward. And the same with most decisions in life. You know, you're just trying to improve yourself. You've got a limited period, you know, of life. Why wouldn't you try and make the most of it? There's no point looking backwards at things that have gone wrong. You learn from them, but you've got to go forward, you know.
Very true. I mean, the best thing about a breakup is the pain of existing is so painful you have no choice but to change. Like, it highlights everything in your life that's lacking. And
yeah,
if you do nothing, you're just going to be, you know, hurting. So, you know, might as well go, you know, talk to people, hang out, try things I haven't, get wrecked. Get humbled because you're already, you know, fragile. I can never imagine a family. Eh?
Yeah. Other people, you know, you've got to put your, you know, a relationship breakdown, you know, put that into perspective that someone that actually, you know, loses the love of their life through an accident, cancer, you know, there's perspective in life as well. And you kind of think, well, actually, you know, we're still here. We've made it to, we made this life, we made this decision, we made this breakup, you know, move on. Other people have got it a whole, you know, if I lost the love of my life, you know, I don't know how that feels. I haven't been there. I can't relate. But I imagine that's bloody tough, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was talking to someone the other day there. Married for a few decades, have young family. Her husband went to climb a tree to help get a kid down. Just fell.
Ooh.
Died. You think...
Yeah, so...
You can't really be surprised by that. I mean, I don't know how I feel. Like, I've had some people die. No one, you know, super, like, your grandparents and stuff, and it's sad, but not for long. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a surprise.
No.
It's like...
it's like, you know, when it goes in the right order, you know... The grandparents, the parents, the children, you know, then that's life kind of thing. But, you know, it's when, like, losing a child, losing a partner young kind of thing, you know, that's kind of you expect when you're in your 70s, 80s that, you know, you're going to start losing people around you. But, you know, you would hope that, you know, in your 30s, 40s that, you know, you don't lose your husband, you don't. Obviously, no one ever wants to lose a kid, you know. So,
yeah, that'd be horrific. Yeah. I think for me, what makes things like that hard would be if, in some way, I feel responsible.
Yeah,
because if someone dies, I'm not surprised, and if they die younger, like, I only have emotions for 5 minutes, so eventually I'll just be like. But maybe, you know, people listening to this have horrific tragedy, and they're like, Ryan, you're so insensitive. I don't know. At some point, emotions are you choosing to keep experiencing them, in my opinion. You can counter me. You can strongly disagree because it's a very. I was just saying that, and this is locally recorded, so if there's a connection lapse, it automatically uploads, so don't worry about that. I was saying I'm a bit savage with death because I don't. Eventually, the emotion ends, and then I'm just choosing to feel the emotion after a point. You know, I'm ruminating on past memories or past experiences, the hurt. I'm thinking about them again, so I'm feeling it again. And there'll be people listening to this that would be like, insensitive. Oh, you're so insensitive.
Yeah, you are, obviously.
So go on. You bail me up. But yeah, what's the count of you?
I think that... I mean, I like I said, I haven't experienced really. I mean, I lost my mum, you know, and that was a tough experience. But I mean, she was in her 80s. You know, people don't live forever. I know that. You know that sort of thing. You've got to expect it. I haven't lost a sibling. I haven't lost a child. I've lost some close friends. And that was tough. And there were some really sort of hard periods, you know, but it's just, I guess it makes you make the most of your own life for a while.
Yeah. I mean, you can't, tragedy's going to touch you. Like it does, you know, everyone you love will die. Something's horrific's going to happen.
Yeah.
Probably even just growing your business and no one understanding what it's like. And then they see you, you know, you reach a certain level of success and, oh, it must have been easy. You're like, oh, yeah, yeah, it was cruisy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course it was. Yeah.
Piece of cake.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What's your take on that, though? Like tall poppy syndrome or whatever. I kind of like it because it means they have less competition because people are scared. But what's your thing about bringing people down or minimizing their success or saying, oh, it was different for you? What was your take on that?
I don't think that I'm definitely not one to look at people and think, you know, you were handed that on a plate very often, because I know the reality, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, when we set up G3 and we had sort of no money whatsoever coming in because we grew it organically, we had no clients from the get-go, and but we had staff that we had to pay, sort of thing. So, you know, it was pretty tough. I took on a second job, you know, I did a night audit, so I was working 5 days a week in the office, and then I was doing 11 till 7 on a Friday and Saturday night, you know, doing a hotel night audit. To put, we had 7 kids in our blended family, you know, so we needed to put food on the table. They had school trips. They needed to go on, you know, we had to buy a uniform. And so I was knackered, you know, and it was a really, and it, there was lots of actually, you know, why did I do this? Because I could quite easily walk in and get another financial planning job, and have a regular salary. And so it's actually having the commitment and the, I guess, the confidence that it's going to turn a corner. And it did, and it didn't. It did, thank God. But it was tough. And, you know, you look at a lot of these businesses and, you know, yes, some people make it look very easy, but you don't know what's gone on. You know, nobody really talks about the shit times when they are successful, no. You know, because they don't want people to sort of know that they were actually, you know, in that situation.
Oh, it's wild. It's wild. So, like, how unsuccessful people's perceived success really is. You know, when you actually sit down, because I did a challenge, I think. I talked to 100 people in a month or whatever. I can't remember. It was like 25 people a week. Maybe it was 200. And I was just asking them real stuff. How are you going? They're like, oh, absolutely butchered. My wife's left me. Someone's got cancer. Oh, my business, we're making $1 million a year, but I'm only making 30 grand. And you look at their Instagram posts.
Yeah, well, that's it. Like, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, you see you know, families that, you know, they're driving the flashiest car, they've got the big flash house sort of thing. They might be in their 40s in Auckland and they look like they're living the dream with everything. But there's very little margin and, you know, it's all debt. It's the stress of the mortgage payments, the car repayments, you know, it's all image. And you just kind of think, you know, is it really worth it? You know, have the cheaper house, have the second-hand car, you know, and have the life, you know?
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on.